This is a Career Channel program from UC San Diego Extension. Visit us at www.uctv.tv/careers for videos, employment news, and trend articles to help recent college graduates and grads in career transition bridge to better employment.
Hello, and welcome to The Pulse, Issues in Healthcare. I'm Leslie Bruce, your host and the Director of Healthcare Leadership and Community Outreach for UC San Diego Extension. Today's guest is Dr. Rodney Hood. Welcome, Dr. Hood.
Welcome, and thank you for inviting me, Leslie.
Happy to have you. Dr. Hood is a board-certified internist who has been in private medical practice for more than 30 years and is managing partner of CareView Medical Group in San Diego. He co-founded and is president of the Multicultural Primary Physician Medical Group, a 300-physician independent practice association, and founded CompCare, a 7,000 enrollee Medicaid health plan. So let's start with how you came to practice medicine, because your educational path is somewhat unconventional.
Yeah, well, thank you, Leslie. I think it's unconventional only because it wasn't planned. I'm originally from the East Coast, Boston, Massachusetts. I went to pharmacy school in Boston. With really not much thought about medicine. And when I completed my pharmacy degree, I was really interested in research in pharmacology, toxicology, and actually got accepted at the PhD program at UC San Francisco. And that's what brought me out to California. So mm-hmm. As a graduate student, I had the ability to take classes with the medical students. And that's when my interest and passion in medicine began. And after a year of graduate school, I switched to medical school, got accepted down here in UCSD, and I've been here ever since.
So you are an illustrious alum of UC San Diego. Well, we're very proud of that, I can tell you. You practice now in the Diamond District of San Diego. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that area and the patients you serve there?
Yeah, well, the Diamond District is composed of several zip codes, but mostly it's a underserved, very diverse, multi-ethnic community that I've been in for 35 years now. I completed my medical school and internal medicine training at UCSD, and I had developed a relationship with many of the physicians that had already started practicing down in the Diamond District or Southeast San Diego. And at that time, as a student, we had to do a research project. And my research project was on the origin of the sickle cell gene. Mm. So that's what started me going down into that area, completing my project with the help of some of the physicians. And so after I finished my training, I decided just to continue to practice in that area.
And is there such a thing as a typical patient that you have? I'm sure there must be some commonalities. Help us understand the individual patient.
Yeah. Well, I think all patients are patients. And I mean that whether they're whatever their income, whatever their diversity, it's just that certain patients have other needs. And my particular patient population is an underserved area, mm-hmm. very low income area, very diverse. I see a lot of African Americans, Hispanic, Mexican Americans, Asian American patients, as well as Europeans. So it's extremely diverse. Mm-hmm. And what I find is that many times they have, we used to call them non-compliant. Uh-huh. And what we're finding out is it's really not non-compliant. It's lack of resources to be compliant with what we in medicine think they should be doing, taking their medications, keeping their appointments. Many times it's the social infrastructure of their environment, their low income, lack of transportation, lack of knowledge how to navigate through the system to access their benefits. And so by learning that, which took me quite a while, we had to figure out how can we help them overcome those barriers. And several programs that I've been involved in has now taught us that if you can help them overcome those barriers, they become the most compliant patients that you've ever wanted to take care of.
Isn't that interesting? Well, you know, you talk about your sickle cell project and you know, introducing you to the area. What drew you to a lifetime of practicing in an underserved area?
It really wasn't planned. It was just something that I've always, coming from an underserved area in Boston, Roxbury, and when I came out here, I recognized the need for going back to the community and contributing any knowledge that I had. And at that time at UCSD, they had a community health department. And I worked with Ruth, who was my mentor, and helped me develop the relationship with the community and my project. I'm talking about Dr. Ruth Covell.
Covell, I was going to say.
Yeah,
I betcha.
Who was my mentor in a project. And so that's how I got involved. And once when I saw that, I have an expression that I tell my children. What should I do? Should I go into this field or that field? This field offers more income. And I said, don't look at it that way. Follow your passion. Mm. And so when I started working in that area, it clearly became my passion. That's what made me happy. Mm-hmm. And I went into primary care, internal medicine. My practice was started in that area as a general internal medicine practice. And patients, I often said I never had a problem getting busy, just getting paid for being busy. Many of my colleagues would complain about things were slowing down. I've never had a slow period as far as I could see. I always had to limit the number of patients I saw rather than worry about getting more patients.
I understand. Very interesting. Well, speaking of your passion, this country is deeply engaged in conversations about racism of late, usually in the context of violence. But you've spent a lifetime talking about how racism affects health. How does racism affect health?
Well, racism affects health on all levels. And most folks never really understood nor deal with the intersection of racism and health. But racism affects health like violence affects health, like lack of income affects health. It's a social barrier. And it is operating on several levels that really affect health. It's the structural racist policies that have existed for years, making it more difficult for people of color to really get access to insurance. And once when they do, learning to navigate the system. So many times the problem of improving health was always felt if we improved access, everything would be equal. Well, what we're finding out is that even after we improve access, and then we look at how people are faring in the health system, all of whom have access, we find there are certain populations that are not doing as well. Their outcomes are worse. Mm-hmm. Their interaction with the health system is worse. And when you delve down into why, some of it deals with the structural barriers. Some of it deals with how the health system perceives them and interacts with them. Mm-hmm. There was a recent study done that showed that physicians in general, when they were dealing with end-of-life care, were less empathetic and touching with African-American patients than non-African-American patients. There's the issue of implicit bias, in which they've documented where physicians and providers subconsciously make more negative decisions for African Americans and Latinos than they do their other patients. And it's really done on a subconscious level. The importance of knowing that is that if they're able to realize they have this subconscious bias, evidence suggests it goes away.
That's remarkable. And I know you're undertaking a number of efforts to make sure to mm-hmm. raise that awareness
Absolutely.
And to make sure that that goes away. You know, on this very note, I think you have noted in the past that a baby born in southeastern San Diego has a life expectancy of 77 years, where while one born a few miles away, say in La Jolla, can expect to live to 85.
Isn't that interesting? I think there are now data where you can actually put in your zip code and it will tell you a baby born in that zip code what the life expectancy is. And it suggests that where you were born is more determinative of your health outcomes and your life expectancy than your genetic makeup. So place actually matters.
Mm-hmm.
But what also matters is race, because, you know, people say, well, that has to do with income. So if you're born in a low-income area, your outcome's going to be less, and that is certainly part of it. But what we're now looking at are areas that have low income, that have a mixed group, African-Americans, Latinos, et cetera. And within that same zip code, we're finding that certain ethnicities live longer than others within the same structure and obstacles. And the question is why?
Mm.
And we're actually trying to do research to answer some of those questions.
I will be very interested to hear how that turns out, that research, and we'll have you back for sure to talk about it. So give us a sense. What is, you know, we hear the words health equity. We hear the words health disparities. What do those mean?
Mm-hmm. That is a very interesting question and a very important question, because I think people conflate the two.
Mm-hmm, I think so, too.
Yeah. Health disparity simply means if you look at different populations, either by age, either by sex, or either by geography or by race, you're going to see differences. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And the differences could be cultural, social, et cetera. Health equity is talking about not necessarily equal, but does the system treat each of those individuals in an equitable way that meets their needs? So in essence, I often talk about health disparities and initiating solutions. So if we start out with the major population whose health level is at 8, and the goal is to get to 10, and another group whose health level is at 6, and the goal is to get to 10. The thought is, let's create a program that's going to lift everybody's boat up.
Mm-hmm.
And we come in with a very positive solution that helps everybody. So the group that was at 8 now is at 9. And the group that was at 6 is now is at 7. But there's still a disparity.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, the disparity is worse.
Mm.
So what we're learning is that it's not just lifting everybody's boat up. We have to incorporate the concept of hotspotting, where if we see groups that are more disparate, we need to come up with specific interventions that are going to lift them up 100%, where another group may only need to lift up 20%.
Gotcha. Can you give us some examples? I think the health disparities, I think, you know, some of them are fairly interesting, and you would expect perhaps the white population to always have better outcomes, but they don't always, you know. And when mm-hmm. you look at health disparities, what are some examples of how one population fares better than another?
Yeah. So I think when we talk about disparities, initially, especially if we're talking about racial and ethnic disparities, we have put all minorities in the same group, that they must be worse than the major population.
Mm-hmm.
So whites have the best and all minorities are worse. But if you cone down, that's not true. One of the biggest disparities is life expectancy. The average life expectancy in this country is about 78 years. If we look at the disparity amongst ethnicities, we'll see that Asians have the highest life expectancy, followed by Hispanics, who have the next highest life expectancy, followed by whites, mm-hmm. followed by Native Americans, and lowest are African Americans. So now we have a situation where Latinos, Mexicans, who have lower poverty levels, sometimes more than blacks, worse access, yet their life expectancy is greater than whites. There's a paradox there.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should try to understand that
uh-huh.
to get to solutions.
It's fascinating. I find that just amazing. And I know that at least at some point when it came to infant mortality, Latino populations had less infant mortality than whites.
Exactly.
And it's just very interesting, how that these aren't as obvious as people would think. Mm-hmm. So why is it so important to end health disparities?
Well, many reasons. One, it's the right thing to do. Okay. I think we should all have equal access to health, all receive the same type of quality access to health care. But unfortunately, many times our system is based upon a capitalistic system where we got fee-for-service and billing. And what we're now finding out is that these disparities are costing the system too much money. There's one study that suggests over $80 billion in excess is mainly due to disparities. So just think if we had programs to begin to eliminate those disparities, the amount of money that could be saved.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So going back to the concept of hotspotting, if you say I have $100 million that I want to lift everybody's boat up, maybe $80 million of that needs to be focused on the most disparate populations
mm-hmm.
because you, not only are you going to, A, be doing the right thing, but you're going to be saving the most money.
Very interesting, and certainly a word that needs to get out.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you introduced me to a concept a number of years ago was microaggression.
Mm.
And you gave a wonderful example of you were jogging back from your bank to the car. Does this ring a bell with you?
With my wife?
Yes. You were exactly. And I don't want to blow this, so I'm going to let you tell it. But we were in a classroom full of post-baccalaureate pre-medical students, and you shared this story about jogging back to your car.
Mm.
Would you tell our listeners that story?
Well, I think I need to give a background.
Please.
This really came about when everybody's talking about Black Lives Matter.
Mm-hmm.
And we're seeing what's happening in Ferguson and Katrina and Flint. And a conversation began with me and some of my colleagues who were white. And one of them was in the African-American community, we commonly talk about driving while black. It's very common for young black men to get pulled over at a much higher rate, whether it's in San Diego or whatever city we're in. And I was telling them how I actually had to have a conversation with my son, who's much older now, about what to do and how to conduct himself if he ever got pulled over by police. And most of my white colleagues said, why? They've never had that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So no matter, and I myself have been quite affluent, okay? And my son was not in poverty yet. We know that just because of who he is, he's at jeopardy. So now America is becoming more and more aware of these types of disparities that are taking place in the African-American community, that it's not just the underserved poor. And while Ferguson was going on and these other things were going on, I and my wife was in a car, and I was in a hurry, and I ran to the bank to go to the ATM, and I ran back to the car, and my wife said to me without a smile on her face, why in the hell are you running? They're going to think you were robbing the bank. And I stopped and I started laughing, and she said, this is America. So I just used that as an example of, here's a group of people that think in a way that most don't have to think.
Mm-hmm.
When you're driving and you get pulled over, okay, even today, I sit back, I put my hands on the wheel. So these, over a long period of time, there are different reactions that I think African Americans have when they're coming in contact with the law, when they're going for interviews, that creates a certain stress level. They're now researching that. And we're calling it allostatic load. Allostatic load is chronic life stresses that create physiological responses and increase certain hormones that are causing changes in the vasculature that can increase your blood pressure, effects on the heart, effects on the kidney. And they're now beginning to measure this in different populations. And in some preliminary studies, they're finding that African-Americans, especially African-American females, have some of the highest allostatic loads compared to anybody else. This may explain why African-American females, who even at higher income levels, have higher infant mortality rates than equivalent whites.
That's fascinating, and I think that is something we need to learn more about and address. And speaking of addressing these issues, I definitely want to talk about the Multicultural Health Foundation, because your commitment to end health disparities doesn't end with a series of doctor-patient encounters. And so you are founder, president, and chairman of the Multicultural Health Foundation in San Diego. And I know you have initiated a number of measures to reduce disparities and to improve health. So I'd love to talk about some of those initiatives, starting with the Patient Health Improvement Initiative. Tell us about that. How is that moving the needle and being part of the solution to these issues that we just got through discussing?
Okay. Thank you. So the Patient Health Improvement Initiative is actually started with a CMMI innovation grant that my IPA, the Multicultural Medical Group, which was not the foundation, was identified to participate in a national study. Dr. Jeffrey.
If you would just tell people what the CMMI grants were, very coveted and very few and far between, and you got one. If you could just tell us a little bit what exactly that is.
So the CMMI grants is the Center for Medicare, Medicaid Innovation Center. That was maybe about $3-4 billion was put into that. And their goal was to identify groups, providers, entities throughout the country that could come up with innovative ways that would improve quality and save money. One of the grants was a CMMI grant associated with Dr. Jeffrey Brenner, who started the concept of hotspotting in Camden, New Jersey. Many articles have been written about him. He became a scholar, received the MacArthur Award. Well, they wanted to see if what he did in Camden, New Jersey could be duplicated throughout the country. I was fortunate to have met Dr. Brenner, and we were identified. There were four other sites identified. One was in Pennsylvania, Colorado, here in San Diego, and Kansas City, plus Camden. So for 3 years, we were a part of sites that were identifying the sickest, most complicated patients, putting together a local community-based intervention team that was identifying patients, trying to, we call it home healthy and safe. So our goal was to go into their homes, identify social barriers as well as clinical barriers, and on a weekly basis, developing plans that we could assist them to stay out of the hospital and stay home. Our team consists of patient navigators, nurses. I was the medical director in a whole administrative arm. We met regularly. We met with the health plans and assisted the patient in the health plan with these patients navigating the system. And over a three-year period, we found we were extremely successful. One health plan, we were able to save over $4 million. Just one health plan for about 60 patients. Our IPA looked at the group, and part of how IPA manages and does well is by helping to decrease the utilization of their patients. We saw 1 year prior versus 1 year afterwards, just on the IPA level, there was a savings of about $200,000. This data was enough to convince the IPA, a health system, to now contract with the Patient Health Improvement post-grant to continue that intervention strategy.
Mm-hmm.
And what we realized was that although these patients were in the health system and they had access, they had insurance, the plan was able to help them navigate the system, stay out of the hospital. Hospitalization went down about 40%. ER visits went down about 30%. And those dollars were translated into savings. What we're now doing is continuing that, and we're creating what we call a wellness fund, meaning from those savings, we're putting money aside so that we can expand the program. Because what we find—
Sustainable.
Yeah, we're trying to make it sustainable.
Mm-hmm.
What's going to make it sustainable?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we always need more physicians, but I think what we need is more community infrastructure. So we got a small grant from Kaiser in which we're training about 25 community health workers to continue to help us work with these patients after the intervention. The intervention was about 6 months. And without continued support, many tend to regress back to that behavior.
Sure.
We find by putting in the infrastructure, calling these folks every week, and if we just find actionable items, then we can reengage them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been effective at prolonging the success that the patients are healthy.
Now, do those community health workers who continue to help these patients after the six-month period, are they able to connect these patients with social services and that kind of thing? Because we're finding, of course, that investment in social services is an investment in health also, and that's something that we're just sort of coming around to.
Mm-hmm. So you're right, and that's part of the training. That's where we are now. Our initial group that was helping us with this were really volunteers.
Mm.
Some of them, Leslie, came from your class.
I'm thrilled about that, to be perfectly honest.
Kevin Liu is mm-hmm. our chief volunteer who's been with us since the inception. And so many of them were community-based, faith-based volunteers. Mm-hmm. Many of them were post-bac volunteers. Some of them were UCSD medical students. So what we're now doing is we're trying to actually look for a grant that's going to help us start training folks who actually live in the community.
Oh, what a great idea.
To continue this, because one of the other social barriers is jobs.
Yes.
And so by training somebody who could be effective at just interacting with these patients afterwards, visiting them at home. One of the things Kevin does and some of the other volunteers, they'll call them up. They're having problems getting on the internet. He'll go by, help them solve the internet problem while he's there, call up the nurse, say, they're running out of their cardiac medication. The nurse will interact, call the office, try to get them to get their medications. So we're picking up things before it happens.
Well, I like the fact that here you are providing a job opportunity, and yet it's still saving the system so much money, even with that salary that has to be paid. Mm-hmm. The savings for and the patient outcomes are so significant that it is a wise investment.
Yeah, we call it a reinvestment model.
Excellent. Makes sense. Well, one of the other aspects that I find particularly interesting about the foundation is the think tank. I mean, we have very few think tanks in San Diego, and I would love for you to explain a little bit about why you have a think tank and what it is doing.
Okay. So we have the Multicultural Health Foundation is 501c3, and basically we're learning to combine the for-profit entities with the not-for-profit entities, because many of the patient populations that my practice has taken care of, I'm not a 501c3, that the IPA took care of,
mm-hmm.
70-80% of the problems are social. So by creating a not-for-profit entity that just focuses on that, our health system has not learned how to find the value of paying for that intervention.
Exactly.
This model is beginning to show them, you're now responsible for these patients. You're now responsible for paying the bill. We can show you by giving us an infrastructure to do the intervention that has a cost, that cost may be $1 million, we can save you $4 million.
Mm-hmm.
And slowly but surely, they're beginning to learn that value. And so what we're trying to do is try to get the health system to learn that paying for the social intervention is cost effective.
And other countries certainly have been very successful with that model.
They've been extremely successful with that model, but we're just learning about it.
Yes, we certainly are. And our, you know, financing system has just been completely unsupportive in that, you know, the changing of our health financing is essential to the success.
Exactly.
All right. So looking at your efforts to identify the best practices, I mean, obviously the CMMI grant was all about creating a model that could be replicated elsewhere. And you're continuing that with your think tank, trying to find best practices. And so how are you disseminating those kinds of findings that you're creating?
So I think both physicians and community need to be educated about this model. They need to be, we talk about empowerment. So one of the ways you change individuals is you empower them to know that they have the power not only to change their behavior, but once when they learn how to navigate the system, they're now learning how to obtain access that they didn't know how to obtain. And so what HEAT is, mm-hmm. Health Equity Action Think Tank. There are a lot of think tanks. We decided we just didn't want another think tank. We wanted one that was going to take action. And so we are putting together a series of community engagement seminars where we're trying to bring providers as well as community and patients in the same room in the community. We're trying to change the culture of physicians, not just to stay in their clinics and write prescriptions and take the blood pressure, but actually get involved with their patients in their community. I just headed, there's a REACH grant. So one of the things HEAT does is it tries to do community-based research.
Mm-hmm.
We're working with the American Heart Association on a project called Check, Change, and Control, focused on African Americans with hypertension. Blacks have the highest hypertensive rate. We're working with Be There San Diego and the REACH grant, which is part of Be There San Diego, which is focused on Southeast San Diego in the African-American community. Why? Because Be There is trying to eliminate heart attacks and strokes in San Diego County. One of the highest rates of heart attacks and strokes is Southeast San Diego. So the REACH grant is designed to do a hotspot on Southeast San Diego. So I'm involved with that. And mm-hmm. What I recently did was pull together about 70, 80 providers who are taking care of patients in Southeast San Diego, brought them together with ministers saying, we need to start thinking of how we can work better together. This is what HEAT does.
Oh, that is fascinating. And I love the fact that physicians are getting out. And I think that it's most important in this particular community.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, how do you get patients there? How do you get somebody to get out of their house and come learn about the healthcare system?
You know, it is surprising. They're very anxious to do so.
Really?
They're very anxious to do so, especially because one of the things our team does is we develop relationships with these patients.
Mm-hmm.
A few of the patients that were enrolled in this patient health improvement initiative were patients that I, as a provider, was taking care of for 10 or more years. I learned more about that patient in the first 6 months of their being enrolled in my program than I knew the past 10 years before, because now the staff is actually going to the home, bringing back information I didn't know about, allowing me to have a conversation with this patient on things I didn't know about. The other benefit is they're calling my team more than they're calling me.
Uh-huh.
So before, we were getting bombarded with the patient always having issues and calling the office. Now they have others that they're dealing with, helping them with their medication. So it really helps physicians learn the team approach, especially with these difficult patients.
Absolutely. And team approach is vital, and especially going forward, absolutely vital. So I think it's very interesting. You know, we there used to be the phrase patient-centered, and we're still using it. But I think, you know, the even more current term is person-centered.
Absolutely.
And you're talking about knowing more about your patient than them just as a patient.
Correct.
And how you as a physician can impact their health by knowing all of that and being mm-hmm. able to contribute to other aspects of their life, whether it's through your staff or directly. I think that's very interesting and very cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the things I think is interesting is obviously you work with this very multi-ethnic population. And I wondered, for purposes of your initiatives at the foundation, how you define multicultural.
Excellent question, because people ask me that all the time. I remember when I first formed the Multicultural IPA, maybe about 23 years ago, we were simply trying to bring all the ethnic doctors, including Caucasians, into a group that we could operate together. And one of my white colleagues said to me, "Rodney, can I join?" Pause. I said, "As long as you're a physician and you have culture." To me, multicultural is inclusive, not exclusive. Okay?
I think that's an important point to make.
Yeah. So it's not just for, quote, minorities. It was a term used to include minorities as well as everybody else. So the Multicultural IPA, on our board, on our contract, on a specialist, has all of the ethnic groups. Now, what that allows us to do, though, is to begin to learn about each other's cultures in a very positive way.
Sure.
An example. At the meeting, there's a new cardiovascular risk calculator that's come out, recommended by the American Heart Association and the American Cardiology College. And it's calculating what is the risk of an individual of having a heart attack and stroke. What's new about this new calculator is it now includes race. So the Framingham study data and putting those risks in there with diabetes and cholesterol and smoking, et cetera, has always been around. Now they have that, and they refined it to include race. I've started using that with my patients. What's interesting is that when I put in all the data, the blood pressure, the cholesterol, smoking, then I click race, African-American, 50-year-old male, 25% risk of having a cardiac event in the next 10 years. I change no numbers except race, and it goes down to 10%.
Wow.
That starts a dialogue.
Sure.
The patient now. And what I was telling my Latino and Caucasian colleagues, use this as a way to start the dialogue. You're not making them feel uncomfortable by saying you're the problem. This is. And how I use it with my African-American patients, I said, you can't change your race, but you can change your diet. You can take your medication. And let me show you what happens when the cholesterol comes down. You can change that. Let me show you what happens if you stop smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the numbers start dropping. That's very impressive to them because they can change those
exactly.
things.
Exactly. That's something they can change. Very, very interesting. Well, that leads me to wellness. And I know that your foundation is also focused on wellness. And you talk about a multicultural wellness center.
Mm-hmm.
Is that up and running, or is that being underway, or where are you with that, and what is it going to do?
So right now we are talking about it, and we're looking for funding for it, to be honest.
Okay.
What we realize is that a lot of our focus has been downstream.
I see.
We realize that long term we need to move upstream to wellness.
To the prevention part.
And the reason why nobody really deals with prevention is there's no money in it.
I know.
Okay? We're developing a model by saying focus on the downstream and commit savings to move upstream.
Aha. Uh-huh.
What's happening is people are focusing on the downstream, saying, look at all this money we saved, and they're keeping it downstream. That's where our wellness model comes in. That's where our wellness fund comes in.
And that's part of your sustainable business model.
Yes.
Exactly. In efforts like this to create great change, and you've certainly been successful for a very long time in moving the needle, it normally takes a village, as they say. So I know you're not in this alone. Who are you working with? What kinds of partners do you have in your efforts?
We have many, many partners. And one of my first partners is Dr. Richard Butcher.
Good man.
He's an individual, but I would not have been able to do this without him. He and I, there are three providers at Caravee Medical Group, myself, Dr. Butcher, and we now have a nurse practitioner. And Dr. Butcher is also part of my board of the Multicultural Health Foundation. He's also the medical director for the Multicultural IPA. And I would not have been able to do any of this without his help. So if you talk about partners, I want to start there.
That's good.
However, organizational partners that we've developed with the Multicultural Health Foundation include Be There San Diego, which is a countywide initiative to eliminate heart attacks and strokes. Dr. Anthony DeMaria, UCSD, has invited me to the table at the Be There. And was when I invited him to Southeast San Diego to say, hey, if we want to eliminate heart attacks and strokes, let's start here. And it was with that that he said, yes, I think that's a good idea. That's how we wound up with the REACH grant. I think our other partners are the American Heart Association that has a focus on disparities in cardiovascular disease. So we're developing a relationship with them. Kaiser Foundation has programs that we're working with. So we've actually signed memorandums of understanding, the Multicultural Health Foundation would Be There, Kaiser, American Heart Association. And we're also working with local community groups, UAMIC, which is the United African American Ministerial Alliance. They're engaged in this program.
Very influential.
We're working with the Black San Diego Black Nurses Association. We're working with many other faith-based organizations. We're working with the local National Medical Association. So all of these folks are partners.
That's terrific. That's terrific. No wonder you are making progress and things are moving forward. Well, I know that many of my students, whether they're undergraduate or graduate students, are interested in volunteer opportunities, especially in medicine. So are there ways that they can contribute their time to the Multicultural Health Foundation?
Yeah, absolutely. We're always looking for volunteers. We just brought on a lead volunteer, which is Kevin, who actually came from your program. And the website for the foundation is mhfwellness.org, mhfwellness.org. And that's for the Multicultural Health Foundation. And on there, you'll find a place where volunteers and how to access and become a volunteer. There are several ways volunteers can be helpful. First of all, as we interact with patients, we train volunteers to interact with them by calling them on a weekly basis, identifying their needs. And then many of them may need a home visit for just comfort. Some of them need certain things done that the volunteers may have expertise at doing. For instance, I mentioned the computer, helping them get online. Kevin's been very helpful with that. So they're and we now have a grant that from Kaiser in which we're trying to identify 25 volunteers. Many of them have been medical students, undergraduate medical students. You don't have to be a medical student. And we're training them to do community intervention.
That's terrific. I'm going to announce that in a couple of classes here very soon because there is tremendous interest. I can tell you that. Transportation is sometimes an issue, with particularly the undergrads, but that's something we can figure out. So last but not least, of course, there are other people who perhaps don't have time to contribute, would like to somehow make a donation to your success somehow. And so how can they do that?
We are looking for donations, and by going to our website, mhfwellness.org, there's a place on there where you can make a donation. And Leslie, I'm aware that you made a donation. Thank you so much. It's very easy to do. What we use that money for is to do the community engagement. Mm-hmm. So it's not really going to overhead, but it's what we're using to things come up. Some of our patients will come up and they don't have food. Mm. And yes, we use 211 and other access source and food sources, but sometimes they need it now.
Sure.
So by having a little fun, we can pull off into, bring them right now. That's being done sometimes. The volunteers and the staff are coming out of their own pocket. We're trying to build up a fund where we don't have to rely on that.
I understand. Well, your town hall meeting back, it was in December, I think.
December 1st.
Yes, was so powerful that I just wanted to be part of that. So I'm hopeful that other people, you know, are now going to be aware of your good work and want to participate as well. So thank you so much for being here. We really appreciate having you. It's been such a pleasure, and we wish you every success. I want to thank our listeners also and encourage anyone who wants to be notified of future podcasts to go to extension.ucsd.edu. Click on My Extension and provide your email address, and we'll let you know who the next guest is going to be. If you have suggestions for guests you'd like to hear, please email me at careerchannel@ucsd.edu. Until next time, this is Leslie Bruce. Here's to your health.